Many Americans think of themselves as self-made. They're deeply attached to the idea that they are solely responsible for any success they've enjoyed in their business and personal lives. But according to Brian Miller and Mike Lapham, the authors of The Self-Made Myth, business success depends as much on luck, timing, and the availability of adequate public infrastructure as it does on any single individual's hard work and creativity. Their book is published by BK, and I'm very pleased that it brings Brian Miller and Mike Lapham to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Brian, all of Steve Jobs' obituaries pointed out that he started out with practically nothing. Isn't the idea that any American who's willing to work hard can go from rags to riches almost as old as the country itself?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to the story. And, you know, we're not discounting the fact that a person through hard work can, you know, better their lot. What we're really discounting, what we're really challenging is the notion that work alone is enough to make oneself rich and successful. And Steve Jobs had, for example, had historical timing working in his favor. And there's a lot of other contributing factors that really help a person succeed.
And we'll get to that in a little while. Did the idea grow out of the new nation's rejection of the aristocratic lineage that had determined people's worth in Europe for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tendency to want to believe that someone's success is a result of hard work. And
George Washington was a multimillionaire by he was very rich by his time standards. So were most of the founding fathers.
I think what we try to get at in this book is that if you are wealthy, you did it with a lot of help, not only from other individuals, but you did it with the help of a lot of investment by government that makes that success possible. So even George Washington, anyone in that era, you know, all through our country's history has benefited from investment by our government that makes that success possible.
Although, can we say that Ben Franklin is the one who came up with this idea that if you have a strong enough character and a willingness to work and willingness to sacrifice, you can be successful?
Well, I think Ben Franklin, obviously, he had this Poor Richard's Almanac, which was popular in his day, and really told this story. And again, he really was writing a story on how kids growing up, poor boys usually, could better their lot. And he really focused a lot on character. And again, you know, character is important and work is important, but the problem is when we use that as the only litmus test on whether a person succeeds, it distorts our views on everything from inequality to the role of government to a whole host of factors. And even George Washington and some of the folks that you mentioned a moment ago recognized early on that we really are all in this together. George Washington's first address to Congress was about the need for massive public investments to create ports and postal roads to connect this new nation. And that's really when we started this recognition that we are all in this together and there's a role in sowing that broader foundation.
Horatio Alger is another author whose name comes to mind. Were there a bunch of other people between Franklin and Horatio Alger?
There have been, you know, Horatio Alger and, you know, Ayn Rand.
Well, she's the more recent one.
Right, is the more recent. And, you know, this idea that the rich folks are on their own holding up the earth if they let go, we're in deep trouble. And, you know, we tell a very different story, and the people in this book tell a very different story.
Although I've spoken to some Tea Party members, and they suggest that Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged could be America's second Declaration of Independence. It was published in 1957, but it's become a bestseller again. What are its main arguments?
Well, I think, you know, the story that Ayn Rand really tells is this. It's almost like the Horatio Alger narrative, you know, amplified many times over, because not only are her heroes responsible for their own success, they're responsible for the success of everyone around them. They like the Greek Titan Atlas, hold the world up on their shoulders. And there are those who recognize that that narrative serves a political agenda. John Allison, he's the former head of BB&T, former banker. He's been giving $2 million grants to universities to teach courses on capitalism with Ayn Rand's book as required reading. And 60 universities have already taken him up on the offer, despite the objections of professors.
And Brian, you've said that it's hard to overestimate the significance of Ayn Rand's writing in guiding conservative thinking in the United States. Is that because she's divided the world into two groups, the industrious job creators and everyone else?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And because it really, it characterizes both sides of the self-made myth. On one hand, everyone who's rich is somehow there entirely by their own gumption, hard work, and the sweat of their brow. Everyone who isn't rich is somehow slothful, inept, and not working. And that's a reality we don't accept. The reality is the vast majority of Americans out there in the country work hard every day.
So, Mike, is that why we've been hearing that phrase, job creators, so much frequently recently?
Absolutely. And, you know, this, if you believe in this job creator myth, that it's one person who gets up earlier, works harder, and you're likely to believe that government just gets in the way and that we should get government off that guy's back. And it leads to this whole anti-government, anti-tax narrative that's been very destructive to our country.
So is one of your concerns about the idea that success can be attributed to merit and hard work alone, and anyone who's not successful must be lazy, dishonest, or both?
There's a great story in the book. There's a woman named Gwendolyn Parker who was writing when George Bush was running for president, George II. And she says, think of how many different people's lives he had to reinvent to believe the myth he believed about himself, that he was a successful business person, including my own. She's an African-American woman. And how many people did he have to believe were just lazy to believe that he was a successful business person? And I think that's true for a lot of these people who discount, you know, all the efforts of other people in society and think, I'm the one who made all of this myself, and therefore government should get off my way. You know, taxes should be kept low on me so that I can do more of this stuff. They believe it themselves. And then we transfer that myth to all wealthy people. It's not just business people and small business people. Now we say all wealthy people should have low taxes.
Are we hearing similar arguments in the current debate over the Affordable Care Act, which interestingly originated at the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation?
You know, I think there's a recognition that we do hear. I guess we hear it in the act, in the sense that those who there's a lack of recognition that we're all in it together. The reality is that, and one of the things we talk about in the book, you know, one of the people, there's two things that I'd tie into that, the healthcare issue. One of which is, there's a Gunn Denhart has this wonderful quote in here, you can't build a healthy business in an unhealthy community. And there's a recognition that we are all in this together. And one of the parts of the book that we look at social mobility. And we compare the United States to other countries around the world. And what's interesting is that and the number of small businesses is that in Europe, in most European nations which have universal health care, they have far more small businesses per capita than we do. They even have far more medium-sized businesses per capita than we do. And they have higher social mobility, meaning a person can born low income can rise up during their lifetime. And part of that is because you can go out and start a business without risk and fear of losing your health care. You know, here in the United States, you know, people are desperately clawing to hold on to their health care. That inhibits a person's entrepreneurship, their willingness to strike out on their own. And so there is something to be said by having that foundational support in place allows for more people to experiment and try new things.
But America's still the center of entrepreneurship, isn't it? Don't we have all of these seeding programs? And
Well, I think thanks to a lot of investment by our government, there is opportunity. And I think
so. You think it's the government that has led to this entrepreneurial spirit?
I think it's underappreciated, the role. And I think part of what in this book we profile about a dozen entrepreneurs who are very successful, and all of whom have been profiled probably as self-made in their lifetime, you know, in their success. But they tell a more honest story, and they are willing to say, you know, I got a public education. Martin Rothenberg went to the Brooklyn Public Library and took out all the books on electronics and read them cover to cover. He went to school, public school, went to school on the GI Bill. There was an investment in him, and there was an investment in the employees of his company, Syracuse Language Systems, upstate, you know, that made him successful, and he gave a lot of that money back. But what these people realize is we have to be investing back in those supports that make it possible, the education, the research, the infrastructure in this country that make business make it such a fertile ground. And we're not doing that right now because partly because we're keeping taxes low because of this myth. So we really need to undo this myth and call it like it is and realize that everybody's in it together. Business people don't make their business decisions based on what the tax rate is. We need to stop coddling the rich.
My guests are Mike Lapham and Brian Miller. They've written a book called The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. In the book, you've identified a number of factors outside most people's control that play a significant role in determining success or failure. And you say two of the most important are a person's race and sex.
Absolutely. And I don't think that comes as a surprise to a lot of people.
Although, isn't that changing a bit with women? I just saw Time magazine cover story that said that women are now the wealthier group.
Well, there's certainly progress being made. But, I mean, some of the examples in this book, Thelma Kidd, for example, you know, is a woman who started a business in the 1980s, a bookstore in Tennessee. And she was really breaking through the glass ceiling at the time. It was hard for a woman, and it still is, hard for a woman to walk into a bank and be taken serious as an entrepreneur, as someone starting out, starting their own business. And that's a very unique position to be in. And so she was able to get, she was one of the first recipients in that first year of a new program from the Small Business Administration targeted at women entrepreneurs. And she was able to get this SBA loan to provide seed funding. And that business later grew into a statewide chain with 400 employees and very successful before she sold it.
And I would mention Amy Domini here from Domini Social Investments. She'll be speaking at our event tomorrow night here in New York at the Ethical Culture Society. But she, you know, she founded Domini Social Investments, but she says she wouldn't even have been a stockbroker if it weren't for decisions that allowed her to be, you know, one of the first woman stockbrokers at that time. And so she, thanks to a court decision, you know, just before that time, she was able to break in as a woman. And the book is full of stories. So there is, you know, circumstantial evidence, you know, factors like luck and timing and so forth. And then there's a lot of other factors in terms of government investment.
Well, let's talk about the timing. You point out that the timing of a person's birth is a key factor in their success. And that was particularly true for people born in the United States during the 1830s, when the early fortunes were made?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good data that, you know, when you were born makes a huge difference in your prospects in life. And there was a group of folks who were born in the 30s who came of age right as the Civil War dust had been settling and the entire landscape of the West was being opened up. And so you've got this whole generation of people, you know, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Mellons, who were all born within one decade of each other and rose to extreme and extraordinary wealth by the end of the century. And there's other more recent stories. You mentioned Steve Jobs earlier in the program. Steve Jobs, Bill Joy, Bill Gates, all the big tech giants,
Paul Allen,
they were all born within like 4 or 5 years of each other.
The mid-50s.
Exactly. And they came of age right as mainframes were being outdated and personal computers were dominating the market. And they benefited from, frankly, being born at the right time.
Because an old guy like me was born too soon to have benefited from this tech boom.
You could have been a contender.
If I just waited 15, 20 years, well, whatever. You also discovered that very few of the country's most successful business entrepreneurs started out poor.
Sure. Some of these people, you know, like Martin Rothenberg, who I mentioned, you know, Jerry Fidler said, you know, he would have never gone to school. Jerry Fidler founded Wind River Systems. He's another one of the stories in the book. Wind River Systems is the embedded software that's in your camera, in the Mars rover lander, in the internet. He sold that company to Intel for several hundred million dollars a few years back. But he says, I would have never gone to graduate school. I would have never gone to even to college, you know, and you just keep stepping back and back. For someone like me who comes from a working class background, I never would have had that opportunity if government hadn't invested in me.
But he was working class. You've also looked closely at the lives of four wealthy Americans who boasted about being self-made, Donald Trump, Ross Perot, and the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch. So when you look carefully at their backgrounds, you discover that each of them benefited in a number of ways from public programs and government support?
Yeah.
What did the Donald do?
Well, I think, you know, to start with, going back to the Head Starts point, you know, I think your point's absolutely right. You know, every one of those people started life with a very, very sizable inheritance. In addition, there's another report we've done in the past that we cite in the book called Born on Third Base that documents of the Forbes 400, over a third of them were essentially born, you know, right there on the Forbes 400 or very close to the Forbes 400 list. The kind of stories Mike just told about Jerry Fidler are examples of the way government provides support to enable people who aren't born into that wealth to rise up and join that. And it's vital that we have that, because if we don't have those public investments, it's going to be a land divided into those who are born into wealth and those who are just destined to spend their life at the bottom of the economic ladder.
But even the people who are born into wealth, you point out, have benefited from the government help. Donald Trump inherited millions of dollars, $40 to $200 million from his father, Fred Trump, that his father had created in part by building housing using financing from the FHA during the 30s and 40s. And then Donald received a boost that saved him from financial disaster in 1995 from things like SEC regulations when he sold shares in his Trump hotels and casino resorts.
And he's had a bailout that a lot of poorer folks haven't been able to get. You know, the Koch brothers benefit from oil subsidies, agriculture, farming subsidies, and so forth. You look at Ross Perot, who's also profiled in the book, you know, having benefited from Medicare contracts, you know, which he sold over and over to different states around the country. And yet all of these people are doing things to undermine the social safety net and undermine progressivity of taxes when, in fact, they owe quite a lot to those programs that made it possible.
Does anybody point out that the Koch brothers have grazed livestock on public land?
We do.
And for minuscule fees. Also that they've used the government's power of eminent domain to obtain routes for gas and oil pipelines. They've produced ethanol on government subsidies?
This is when you really take an honest look behind these things, and that's part of the reason we wrote this book, so that when people hear self-made man or job creator, they'll look behind it. There's a gentleman by the name of Nick Hanauer, who is out in Seattle, who wrote an op-ed in the Seattle Times recently and said, I'm not a job creator. I've created big businesses, you know, a couple hundred employees, but I don't just decide I'm going to create jobs. Jobs are created when there's demand from the middle class. And, you know, so he recognizes that this whole thing is a myth, and that people like him owe more taxes. You know, we really need to make it possible to have demand in the middle class.
But you suggest that the self-made myth has a companion, the anti-government narrative. So how are the two linked?
Well, I think, you know, again, going back to this, the Ayn Rand narrative and the Ayn Rand story, you know, this notion that all wealth and economic growth in this country derives from these heroic job creators, these epic heroes, really discounts the role of government. You know, if anything, in her novel and in much right-wing orthodoxy and conversations, is that government gets in the way, it inhibits, and that's part of that narrative. And so it really fuels an anti-government narrative, and importantly, leads to policy choices that are counterproductive to the very kind of prosperity we're trying to create as a nation.
And did Ayn Rand ever write about the highways, the bridges, the airports, the things that the government supplies that benefits business?
Not that we know of. I think her main point was that it was these heroic guys, you know, and so she kind of conveniently left out government investment in education and infrastructure, research. We talk in the book about courts and patents and how important those are, and a number of our people profiled in the book talk about how important it was to be able to protect the things, whether it's Abigail Disney talking about Disney products that were protected by patents or copyrights, or Martin Rothenberg talks about having to sue, et cetera.
Yeah. And if I could pick up on that, you know, I think one of the important things for that we really lift up in the book is that there's two levels at which we all benefit from government. You know, one, we benefit on a personal level, and all the entrepreneurs and business leaders we profiled, again, most of them went to public schools. They benefited from the GI Bill, things like that on a personal level. But on a business level, their business, you know, when you look at education system, for example, you know, you could look at that as a place that where kids who don't have money can get a quality education. But if you flip it and you look at it from the viewpoint of an entrepreneur and a business leader, that's a place that fills their factories, their corporate headquarters with architects to design their buildings, ad agents to develop their ad campaigns, accountants, all educated at taxpayer expense. They reap huge benefits of immense magnitudes from these public investments, and it's only right and fair that they pay progressively more because they are the primary recipients in the end of the game of this economy this government makes possible.
My guests are Brian Miller and Mike Lapham. Their book, The Self-Made Myth, and the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. Listeners have been writing in. A listener from Brooklyn asks, could your guest talk about the negative connotations of the word entitlements and why you think people are incredibly eager to undermine safety nets that help everyone, including those who mistakenly think that they don't rely on public investments?
Right. I think there is a tendency to believe, to not want to take help. You know, part of this myth is, you do it on your own. You do it all by yourself. And I think there's two different narratives in this country. There's one, there's this self-made narrative, but there's also a communitarian narrative that we also need to lift up here.
Well, you cite a 2008 study done by Suzanne Mettler at Cornell University on how well people understand the government social programs.
Right.
Most people who said that they'd never used government programs had received Social Security, Pell Grants, unemployment insurance, veterans benefits,
right,
Medicare.
And there was a terrific article in the Times recently about this as well. People who are very reliant on the safety net but like to deny that they benefit in any way. But when you look carefully, when you look behind it, we all rely on all these things.
So why do you think they're ignoring that? Why do you think that they're unaware of this? I know a number of Tea Party people have worried that the Social Security is going to be messed around with, or Medicare, despite the fact that they're talking about shrinking the government.
Right.
Yeah, I think you know, part of it is that it's so omnipresent, it's around us all the time, that we become, you know, oblivious to it. And you mentioned the study of Mettler. You know, as you mentioned, she went out and she surveyed people, and well over half said they'd never benefited from a government program, because that word government program is a vague term. But then she turned around and she asked very specific questions. Did you ever get a Pell Grant? Did you ever take out Social Security? Did you ever get Medicare?
GI Bill. Right.
And she started getting a tremendous number of people saying yes, including most of the people who previously said they'd never gotten a government program.
Did it turn them around? I suspect that they continued to believe what they believed, because these kinds of beliefs are really ingrained in all of us, aren't they? However we fall along the political spectrum.
Right. I mean, this whole anti-government narrative has been, you know, the last 20, 30 years, this anti-tax, anti-government narrative has been
very
strong.
What about the deregulation move?
And I think it also led to the huge tax cuts that were passed under Bush that have continued and that are, frankly, undermining our country. We're not investing because we say we can't afford it. We have a perfectly wealthy country. It's just that most of the wealth is at the top. We need to roll back those Bush tax cuts. We need to start treating capital gains like regular income. We need to have a strong estate tax. We have a letter at faireconomy.org/openletter that people can sign that to Congress to say we need to do these things. And this tax season, we're going to be pushing that pretty hard.
Brian Miller and Mike Lapham will be speaking tomorrow night at 7 at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. That's at 2 West 64th Street. For more information on that and finding out how you can register for the event, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Their book, The Self-Made Myth, and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed, is published by BK. That's Barrett Kohler Publishers. My great thanks to both of you for being on our show today.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks, Leonard.